Hello, everyone. I'm Kelsey Forrest, and I'm here with our amazing Danielist to go deep into the mystery of the Bombshell Giza pyramid discovery and its ancient connection to the Atlantean Hall of Records.
Great to be here with Kelsey.
Are you ready for all my
I
questions?
really am, and this is exciting because it turns out that with the timing on this is an explosive discovery, and it lines up exactly with something that we shot very recently. So I'm excited about what we can reveal here tonight.
Let's give the people what they want.
Exactly.
Okay. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. First question. I'm excited. Let's begin with the startling discovery of a massive underground construction beneath the Khafre Pyramid at the Giza complex using SPACER radar technology.
Yeah, this is interesting. There's a certain type of technology that is coming into archaeology now. And they've had LIDAR, they've had all these different ones coming up and coming in, but space radar, and particularly this SAR radar in particular, this gives them the ability to, from satellites, come in and take these types of images. And these are extraordinary images. And we'll be rolling these images throughout the night. But what's going to happen here is some of these older structures are going to reveal major secrets that have been kind of eluding mainstream archaeology. So there's been a big fight over humanity's past in the middle of this. And so there have been a number of people, and we've done a number of episodes about the Lost Hall of Records, the Edgar Cayce work, and the whole esoteric mystery school version of the ancient past, which is very, very different. And what happened with this breakthrough is that so much of that work got validated that now mainstream archaeology is going to have to catch up with the amount of ramifications that are involved here. And the problem for them is this. What they basically said was that you had a fairly primitive civilization back there, and they just barely discovered the wheel, and they made these amazing structures and megaliths. Well, now it turns out that these things run 700 yards beneath the structure. So that type of construction alludes to a much larger underground base for it. So therefore, what we're looking at is an incredible civilization capable of advanced technology, advanced construction that is supposed to not exist. So in fact, what we're looking at is a culture in Egypt, which is a legacy culture from something much, much older, which is much more sophisticated. And if anything, as you went along in Egypt, that technology degenerated. But when you go back to the furthest point, you're looking at a technology that, with our current history, doesn't make sense.
Well, so I'm really excited about this question. This is the question I've been dying. Can you give us an idea of what the sleeping prophet Edgar Cayce predicted about the Atlantean Egyptian Hall of Records and Pyramid X beneath the right paw of the
This
Sphinx?
is it. And it's fascinating too, because Edgar Cayce is that amazing figure in
That
the
you talked
background.
about.
Yes. And we've done many episodes on Edgar Cayce, who was really a humble, photographer. He grew up in a farmhouse and he was a Sunday school teacher. But he had this amazing ability to go into trance and had this retrocognitive ability to go and see the ancient past as well as the future. So he's referred to as the sleeping prophet because of these trances that he would go into. Now, there's a lot of people who claim psychic ability, and many people have it that you never even have heard about. But in the case of Edgar Cayce, what we're looking at is somebody who's the most well-documented psychic. So this is somebody who came into it through medical readings, that he could do this psychic diagnostician work where someone would write him a letter from Miami, and he could diagnose them while sitting there in Virginia Beach. And so he was referred to as the father of holistic medicine because of this incredible background that he had. And it all happened actually because he lost his voice originally, and nobody could do it. He was an insurance salesman at the age of 19. He loses his voice, and what happens is nobody can do anything about it, and he has to quit his job and everything. And a hypnotist suggests, I can give you, a suggestion, an auto-suggestion to bring your voice back. And he tries to hypnotize him, he tries to hypnotize him, it doesn't work. And then Cayce turns around and says, wait a minute, I think I can do this myself. I'll do the auto suggestion myself. So he gives himself the suggestion, and he goes into this deep trance, and he comes out with a deep voice talking to this guy, saying the problem is that he has a subluxation in his neck. It's causing his vocal cords to freeze up, and what he needs to do is see an osteopath. And after that, word spreads around that this guy has this amazing ability to go into trance. And with this trance ability, he's able to become this incredible kind of, they call him the Miracle Man of Virginia Beach. That's the way that they portrayed him. But Casey's unusual because he had such a demonstrated record over 40 years of doing this. Hmm. And his accuracy in terms of his predictions has that incredible background. So he's not what you would say is a normal kind of psychic in this. He's somebody who really had the ability as a life's calling. And he struggled with it too, because as a Sunday school teacher, it was frowned upon, especially in the 1920s.
Very much.
But in terms of his Atlantis work, this is what happened. At a certain point, when people were asking him to go back and look at the ancient past, he went back beyond recorded history. And he looked at two groups. The one he called the Sons of Amelius, and the other one was the Belial group. And Amelius were very advanced technologically. They're the ones who are the legacy culture. That's where we get these amazing structures in Peru, these amazing structures at Stonehenge, the amazing structures in Egypt. And by going into this, he was saying, you know, we're coming back around to a point of advancing technology. The culture is awakening from a kind of amnesia, and it is recapturing its ancient past. And part of that recapturing of the past had to do with the Sphinx, because in Casey's work, as we'll discover tonight, what they're finding there between the Khafre pyramid and the Sphinx with that space radar is exactly what he predicted in 1932, which is a gigantic, massive hall of records there beneath that Giza complex. And we'll get into what the records contain as we go along.
Okay, I'll hold off. Okay. What are the stenography symbols used by ancient mystery schools for thousands of years that reveal a link to the amazing new discovery?
Steganography, this is interesting because, you know, we do so much with steganography in the series. It's the X-steganography series. And there's a figure back there named Johann Trithemius. And he was an abbot. He was a monk at the age of 21. And he had these amazing breakthroughs. And he decided, oh, the church, I'm really going to get burned by the church if I reveal this stuff. So he learned about something called steganography, which he said he got from the Greeks who wrote, and what it meant was a page within a page. And inside of those pages, he could be writing a particular thing in code, and if you were an initiate in the knowledge, you would know how to read it. So that's where the whole steganography piece comes from. So we got that, and as you go back through history, we realized there were a number of ancient symbols that they used. And when they use these symbols, they are telling you over time, they're passing things down through the mystery schools saying, this is a secret from Egypt, Pythagoras, Greece, and so on. And they maintain the information. There's a Russian philosopher named G.I. Gurdjieff, and he always said, you know, there's two things out there when you do this kind of research. There's what to do and how to do it. So the what to do is, you know, we all know in religious terms and things like that, turn the other cheek and all that kind of thing. But then there's the how to do it, because how do you actually get the technique to do something on that level? So the how to do it stays hidden and the what to do stays right on the surface. So it's quite interesting in steganography when they pass this down, there are some symbols that come up over and over again that go through all of the cultures. And the one example we're going to use now, I'm going to show this to you, which is an Assyrian image of a figure who is a demon with wings holding a bag. And we can see right up there, this is the figure. And I'm going to show you now a holy religious savior figure, and he's in a different part of the world. This guy is Quetzalcoatl, but he's got the handbag. So the steganography is complete worldwide when, with traditional history, these cultures wouldn't have been talking to each other. If you're over there in Samaria, you're not talking to the Mayans, and yet the symbol is there. That is the effect of the schools, the mystery schools in that tradition, moving around the planet, and they've kept that network over time. And it's interesting because the good guys have it, Quetzalcoatl, who's kind of the hero of the Mayan epics, and the bad guys have it. So, you know, the demonology and the Babylonian Assyrian thing, they're both holding it. The question is, what's the steganography of the handbag?
Yes.
And, you know, it was funny you were talking about it in terms of like a fashion thing, but it is where we have it.
It hasn't been branded quite yet.
Exactly.
Okay, so what is a two-eye stone or firestone in the Casey psychic readings, and how does it fit into the investigation of the Hall of Records?
The two-eye stone, this is the key to what Casey was getting at and what they just discovered with this amazing research of space radar beneath the Khafre Pyramid and the Giza complex. So what Casey said is at a certain point, this Atlantean culture reached a technological height and basically blew themselves up. And the crystal power grid network that they had was worldwide. And so when we see megalith stones in places like Ireland and see them in the Pyrenees and other places, what we're looking at there is an electronic grid, a power grid that ran across the planet. Now, the problem is in traditional history, you know, they basically give you primitive tribes, prehistoric primitive tribes, moving into some culture, and then the Dark Ages, and then you get to us. And the problem is that there's the technology works backward when you get into the ancient portion. So, for example, in the Ptolemy version of Egypt, which is around the Roman period, they can't make the pyramids that they make are terrible. They're not, they don't have any of the astrological, astronomical alignments that the others do. Yeah. So the older culture is more informed. So therefore, you had a high culture. That culture got destroyed, and its remnants come into places like Egypt. Its remnants come into places like the Inca or the Maya, for example. And so this is what we're discovering as we've rediscovered the technology. And it's very interesting because the language that they've used isn't to say, you know, here's the account, here's Atlantis, it blew itself up, we were advanced, but you guys will be advanced and then you'll know what the story is. They left the message in mathematics and geometry for a culture that would get to that height and then be able to read it again. So the two-eye stone in the Casey work is very interesting because in the 1920s, you didn't have people talking about lasers and things like that because they weren't invented yet.
Yeah.
but Casey is saying here that the Atlanteans possessed this two-eye, sometimes called it a firestone, and they ran it with their whole culture. So that was their power grid for the entire culture. And basically what it sounds like is very much like we're developing, and so much of our own chipsets and everything else are based on crystal technology. So Casey's giving us a glimpse there that this is how they got advanced. But he said that what they did with the technology originally is they used it as a kind of a spiritual communion. And so, you know, like you pop open your laptop and you talk to a spiritual master, something like that. And so the Emilius group used it for high purposes. And then the Belial group comes in and imitates them and eventually uses it for a warlike technology. And that's where you get so much of the explosions. And there are stories back there that don't make a whole lot of sense about, you know, these great battles that took place and fire from the sky and all these types of things. Even the Atlantis story.
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of like a War of the Worlds type scenario. And when we look at it this way, we have to really imagine that something different was going on there in history. And so part of this recognition, part of the things we're discovering now.
And accepting.
Yes,
that,
exactly.
Yeah.
And what are they going to do with it? Because if it shows an advanced culture, they're going to have to rewrite history. And that's where the work of the mystery schools and Casey and others came in. They set up the 21st century saying, this is what you're going to rediscover. And the truth is the discoveries of this have been heavily suppressed. They've been working around this since Casey gave those readings in the 1920s and 30s. So traditional archaeology has been working on it for 100 years, and we haven't heard anything about it.
With that, what do you mean by archaeology wars, and why are intelligent agencies in the deep state involved in the quest for ancient artifacts?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Would you ever think that the NSA or the CIA or the NGA would be interested in ancient artifacts? It's pretty odd, isn't it? One of the things we brought to light were a series of intelligence operations that targeted the Casey Foundation. And they planted people inside the organization, the ARE, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, and they wanted to find out about the Hall of Records. They wanted everything that there was to know about it. So they placed agents in there to get this kind of information. When I did research on it, I found that intelligence agencies have done everything, funding millions of dollars every year, looking for things like Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant, and things that you would never in a million years assume the intelligence agencies are interested in.
Yeah.
And yet, there's a whole piece about archaeology wars which figures into so much of geopolitics that we're just not aware of. Everything from the Baghdad Museum looting during the Iraq War, it's a great example. And what happens is if you go into history and you look at people, you know, like Hitler or Mussolini or some of those types, they were always after this quest for these sacred objects. You know, they say that Hitler actually went into Austria because he wanted the Spear of Destiny, which was supposedly the spear that pierced the side of Christ during the crucifixion. So there's a long history of this, and it has to do with the idea that the rulership and the ruling parties and the leadership have occult school connections, and that the secret societies guide them. It's very funny because Rudolf Steiner, who comes up in a lot of the work that we do, is the Austrian kind of genius mystic who set up anthroposophy. He said that in America in 1925, that the political setup was 80% run by secret societies. So you can only imagine, here we are 100 years later, it's probably 100% by now. So understanding what the secret societies are, how the mystery school role plays into this, gives us an idea of why the deep state would be interested in the human origin story and how to manipulate that, but also how to use it. You know, and this gets into very deep territory because we also know that they had things like remote viewing programs, for example. So those are psychic spying programs. And that's a lot of these things that they're working with are exactly what they prefer the public to stay away from.
Yeah, exactly.
But you wouldn't expect it under ordinary circumstances, the interest on the deep state side. But when you get down to something like the human origin past, well, if they have the Egyptian story and it's all based around 18th century information, I mean, you know, how much rewriting do you need to actually do of history? A ton. Because the 18th century, we didn't have radar, we didn't have space radar, we didn't have LIDAR, any of those things. So in fact, all of that and all the lists of kings and all the things, when you get to Egypt, it's a much older culture. It's interesting because Casey puts the culture in the pyramid at 10,500 BC and the Sphinx at 10,500 BC. Traditional archaeology places them at 2,500 BC. Well, that's 8,000 years of difference. So something has to give in that equation, and it's the establishment that is based around and kind of whitewashing the public with that because they're based on 18th century investigations. So that's pretty old history.
Somebody's wrong. I don't think it's Casey. Okay, what does a NASA scientist, the University of Pennsylvania, and the island of Bimini have to do with the hidden discoveries of the ancient Tau'i power grid?
This is interesting because there was a NASA scientist who took an interest in the Casey readings, and his name originally, we thought was William Hutton because he wrote under a pseudonym. Later, when he retired, he wrote under his real name, John Sutton.
And Wyman Harrison.
This guy was like, Casey's readings are so erudite, and they're demonstrating such a kind of a level of intensity around engineering that he wanted to test out and see if he built this two-eye stone, what would happen with it. And so he actually developed the model of the two-eye stone. And he built it as the crystal, blue crystal stone. And he found that he could find all types of electrical and radial appliances from developing it. So he had all kinds of technological ramifications from his delivery of this thing. And he was just using a scale model. So he worked on it for over 20 years. And it's quite interesting because the NASA aspect of this was fascinating because his expertise was propulsion. And he started to realize, oh, what you can do with this is use it to make things fly. And so this is where Casey's work got scientific validation, which is, you know, very hard to get in his era, 1930s. Well, this guy tripped into it and realized, oh, this, something's going on here with this guy. And we need to take these readings on a totally different level. Now, what Casey said about Bimini is really fascinating because the island of Bimini is right off the coast of Florida. It's actually a half hour off of Florida. It's right there. And he said, well, there's part of the group, the Emilius group that was advanced in Atlantis. Their home was right there in Bimini before it went down. And so the island was called Poseidia. And he said, you know, if you're looking, this is rising. The land is rising off the East Coast. And he said, if you look in 68 or 69, you're going to see it's coming up. So he made this prediction in 1940. So in 1968, you have these pilots flying over Bimini, and they see this massive road off of the coast of Bimini. And then they realize it's a wall, and it stretches for 20 miles. So it's an underwater artifact, but we don't have any cultures that supposedly are underwater building things. So our traditional history gets thrown out the window whenever you get around Edgar Casey. And the Bimini Wall, there's no archaeologist that can explain it, but there it is sitting. But according to Casey, it's one of those places where this advanced Emilius Atlantis group placed their records. Mm. And so they put their records there in Egypt between the paw of the Sphinx, under the right paw, in Poseidia, Bimini. It's right off the coast there. It's where the Bimini Road is. And then the other places in Yucatan in Mexico. So those are the three halls of records. And according to Casey, they all say the same thing. And they all have information about the Two-Eye Stone. So this gets us into very deep territory because what we're looking at is advanced technology. It's ancient advanced technology. And because these things are coming up and humanity is rediscovering these things, according to the Casey readings, that's because the same type of disaster is being built up. So basically, if the public doesn't get sharp to these things and realize the nature of what they are and what's going on, that, you know, the general culture will just head into earth changes and a kind of disaster. While the people who are aware of these things can plan for those disasters. And so we're looking at two different levels of IQ when it comes to this. One level that is just a traditional thing that you would say, oh, they couldn't do this back 10,000 years ago. Forget it.
Leave it at that.
Yes. But the mystery schools, the Casey work, Steiner, they're all saying the same thing. No, there's an older culture that's advanced. You're becoming advanced again. Beware. You know, you have to become aware of the whole thing. And that's where you snap out of being a culture with amnesia.
So what can you tell us about the breakaway group studying ancient DNA and advanced apothium?
Yeah, the apothium effect, we did a whole episode, you and I, a documentary on apothium. And apothium is fascinating because deep, deep in the halls of the NSA, the military, and in the CIA, they study things of around the nature of the UFO file, psychic development, and other things. Problem that came up for them when they were developing the UFO file was so many things would happen to a person during an experience like that. Missing time, for example. Yeah. Many of the abductions, Dr. John Mack was a Harvard professor who spoke out on this, and everybody, you know, gave him a hard time back then. This is about 2005. He said, well, the people who come to me and get this kind of therapy about hypnotic regression relating to UFO encounters and things, they have memories of being abducted through things, So he started to realize, well, this is not a physical regular reaction because you can't go through things in ordinary physics. So the more I tracked those cases, I came up with the term apotheum to describe what was happening there. Then when you realize, you know, basically what the government does for 80 years in hiding that kind of information is fascinating. What they're doing is, yeah, they're hiding it because they're building up advanced technology based on their own discoveries, one. But two, everyone has assumed that they're hiding an alien culture and they don't want to tell the public because it will upset religion and all the rest. I don't think so, actually. I think that they haven't learned how to master that apotheum effect because it almost has like a boomerang quality where it's almost impossible to predict what it will do. And so that's where the whole X technology piece comes in when you go into further into those experiments in the past that are kept hidden. Thomas Townsend Brown, Nikola Tesla, and others, they're bringing you into a physics level of reality distortion. So that's why the UFO encounters, you know, when they land, nothing will grow there, for example. Or, you know, people have missing time because time disappears. So there's a whole level of this type of interaction that they need to study apotheum with intense secrecy. So that's why they've developed these X-Protect things, and they kept the secrets around these things for so long that there's no way to come back now to the public and say, yeah, we used your money, we lied to you, and this is what we did with it.
Well, so what are the night side forces?
Night side forces. This is interesting because it comes up a lot, and this is something I guess that all of us together can figure out exactly what this is. So if you look at the work of Rudolf Steiner, if you look at the work of Casey, H.B. Blavatsky and others, they all refer to the Belial groups in the past who developed this advanced technology using nightside technology. And nobody knows what the phrase means, but there's some allusion to the fact in nightside technology that it has to do with the exploitation of solar power. And that what happens is at a certain point, there's a way to use solar power that enhances a human being's ability to use psychic energy. And so there's a combination of the sun with psychic energy, and that what happens in general using nightside forces is it corrupts a society. So it's a, you know, you go from kind of an atomic setup like we have, a nuclear setup, which is a certain type of corruption in society. But if you're able to peer into someone's pineal, pituitary, and psychic levels, then you're able to kind of dominate the entire culture. So the nightside forces are like a kind of mind control. And they are studied in intelligence agencies because they're so fascinated when they look back to look at these cultures and say, what were they doing with these nightside forces? And it's funny, when we were looking at the handbag thing with the steganography piece, the other thing that many of those figures hold is a pine cone. And so the steganography with this is quite interesting because what it relates to is the pineal gland, which anyone who's done any kind of psychic investigation knows all the psychic work comes out of the pineal gland. So there's some knowledge back there of exploiting, let's say, the human being. So when we get into things in our own culture, like artificial intelligence, augmented humans, Neuralink, what we're getting is you're getting tied into the Internet of Things. You're getting thrust into this transhumanist setup. And so there has to be some kind of ethical conversation in the culture, or else ultimately, the technology groups, the ones that use the information and this kind of advanced information from secret societies, they will basically get deep behind somebody's brain and plug themselves in. And so it's kind of a crisis in society. It's not very obvious because people just slip into the technology. And of course, you know, I love technology. I edited a tech magazine for a decade. And so I have no problems with technology, but there is a level of the technology and its invasive purposes. That's where you get the whole night sun thing. It was done once before.
You can speak to that. Okay. Well, so what did Casey and the Mystery School say about Atlantean exotic technology and anti-gravity airships, and how does this relate to the UFO file?
Well, this is interesting because really, if you go back there and look at Casey's work on this, he's giving credit to the Atlantean groups for every kind of technological marvel that we possess, but they seem to be even beyond that. When he's talking about this stuff, though, it doesn't even exist yet. So there he is looking out into the future and retrocognitively into the past. And he's saying, oh, the same group of Atlanteans, they had advanced flight, they had space travel. I mean, if you were to ask an ordinary person back there, you know, do you think maybe there, you know, there's a TV show, Ancient Aliens, right? Well, maybe aliens visited in the ancient past, yeah. But did we have that technology? Were we advanced? I think that's a great gap in our own understanding. Mm-hmm. What Casey's saying is we had the technology, we used it, and we got to such a height that we almost destroyed the entire world, and that there's a huge amnesia that takes place after that, and then slowly but surely we come back and remember the technology, how to use it, and now we're basically coming back to facing ourselves again. So it's an incredible clash, the way he's looking at it. Now, what's extraordinary when you look at the UFO file is very interesting, because when you are talking about the Casey work, the descriptions he gives about the Atlantean airships sound exactly like UFO file technology. So there's something missing there in the record. There's a very interesting quote that he gives when they say, well, you know, you're talking about these airships that the Atlanteans had, like, you know, what did they do? Like, how high could they fly? Give us some details. And he said, well, not only could they fly, you know, basically for as long as far as they wanted to go, they could fly under the water, they could fly through things. So there's that whole kind of apotheum piece again coming in. So therefore, they had those types of abilities 10,000, 12,000 years ago. It leaves us in a strange place. So when you start to get into this whole, you know, starting in 1947, humanity starts to know about the UFO file and flying saucers and everything like that, UAP. It's very unusual because here's Casey saying, well, it's an old technology. As a matter of fact, the best way Casey said he could describe it, he said, well, if you know the Ezekiel story, well, that's Ezekiel looking at one of these Atlantean craft. But then people did the timing on it. Well, Ezekiel's 1500 BC, the Atlanteans are 10,000 BC. Somebody kept the technology 9,000 years in between. So who kept it? And how did they have it 9,000 years after Atlantis went down? If we're to trust the accuracy of Casey, he's the foundation of all this.
Yeah.
He's saying it's the same thing. That what Ezekiel sees as those wheels within a wheel is basically an Atlantean craft. That's an anti-gravity that was in our possession as a technology, as a culture, in 10,500 BC. So it's a very slippery slope for us to keep the old model of humanity. But it's also a slippery slope to have somebody like an intelligence agency cook up an alternate version of the human origin story, which we do see, you know, all of a sudden with the intelligence agencies wanting to talk about the UFO file.
Yeah.
They have their own version ready.
Here's the real one.
Just in case.
Here's the one. We have more editing to do. So how does our modern world, speaking of, push for human augmentation through, everyone knows right now, AI and Neuralink, mm-hmm. relate to the disturbing legends of the Atlantean human hybrid, automatons, and Ahriman?
What we have is, in Steiner's work and in Casey's work, a real foreshadowing of what's coming in the 21st century for us. And it's not pretty if it's not done properly. So this whole idea of an automaton is literally what you would consider a cyborg, what they're talking about with these robots and all the rest. Well, it's very interesting because in the Steiner work, he talks about Ahriman and the Ahrimanic influence through technology that will hit in the 21st century. And the idea is basically to cut you off from your own spirituality and the idea of scientific materialism taking over. So he traces it all the way back to 1840, where a group in Germany came out and said, you know what? If it can't be measured or weighed, it doesn't exist. And they became the scientific materialists and dominated throughout Darwin and all that whole period. So the religious aspect of this was interesting because the churches and stuff were looking at this and saying, yeah, this is a problem. Because on one hand, you know, they had their own dogmas and everything else, but the scientific materialism completely cut out anything spiritual. So the secret societies and the mystery schools, and there are two different kinds, but the ones who were sort of looking out for the culture and trying to move the culture forward, took a look and said, you know, if we don't let out some of this information that we have, we're not going to recognize humanity in 100 years. And so this is what I've called the mystery school wars, where some of those groups are like, no, no, keep the secrecy no matter what. And the other groups were like, no, we have to let it out. And so you get a lot of weird things in the 19th century coming out. Spiritualist movements. Abraham Lincoln was a spiritualist. I'm going to show you a vice president tonight who spent all of his time and resources trying to find the Mayan link to Atlantis. So this whole thing has gone in these political circles for a long time. And what was taking place in that period was Blavatsky came forward in 1875 and developed theosophy, brought it over to America. Theosophy had reincarnation. It had psychic development, life after death, this idea of ascended masters, all these things that just weren't there. And in the heart of it was the Atlantis story. So there was a guy named Ignatius Donnelly, who was a politician, who wrote this incredible book at the same time Blavatsky came out, all about Atlantis. And so suddenly these things were coming into the culture, being placed in the culture to kind of reawaken everyone around this. And it's very interesting to me because what happens a little while after that is you get the incredible increase around scientific materialism. So, you know, psychology kicks in to such a level that there's a number of different schools of psychology, like Carl Jung's psychology versus Freud and all the rest.
Oh, I could tell you all of them.
Yes, indeed. This is the part of the lecture you can take over. But I will say this, that the idea was get people away from the spiritual thing. And because before that, you had New Thought, you had all these other things coming in, which are completely look at humanity in a different fashion. So when you get further along into the 21st century, the thing that we're looking at right now, the idea of augmenting a human so they become superior means you have to implant things in them. And this is where you get, exactly. And so, you know, Musk and many of these figures who are the leading edge on this, they're coming out and saying, hey, you know, it's for the good of humanity. Well, there's no doubt that the technology can do good for humanity. But unfortunately, as we've learned with the leadership structure, it's very often upside down in terms of their ethical values.
Yes.
So if the wrong people get their hands on that technology, we're in the same wreck that Atlantis took place. So the Atlantis piece comes in strangely here, and it's like you can start to see the threads laid down by the mystery school saying, remember this story about your ancient past and you being advanced, but all of that becoming a huge problem. And the interesting thing about the automatons is it makes a big part of Casey's Atlantis history. So he's saying, no, no, it's not just that it's coming, it's that they did it back then already. And this is kind of a cultural memory that they are able to produce these beings. And the idea now, I've seen everything demonstrated from, I did an MIT demonstration for a robot bartender and watched the entire
thing.
Did
he get you some good drinks?
They had a thing, a dial where he would make good conversation. I kid you not. So obviously we already know the technology is interfering with a number of things.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And yet, we don't have any idea in general culture that this all took place previously.
Deja vu.
And so when you go back and look at what's taking place with the space radar that we opened with on this, Well, there's something involved here that I'm referring to as Pyramid X, which is the Hall of Records. Mm-hmm. And Pyramid X is beneath that structure of the Sphinx. This is what Casey identified. We're going to get more into this tonight. But basically, if humanity gets their hands on that information, then it's very different. It's a very different paradigm going forward. And we're not going from the whole, you know, civilization started 6,000 years ago in Sumeria. We're going a lot further back. And so that changes things. That's a consciousness shift that I think would be powerful, considering where we are at this point in the 21st century, which the future is not looking good.
No.
Could be. It could be.
Transparency could help. Okay.
I agree.
Well, that's what you're doing, right? Yeah. This is all transparency
that's
for what, everyone.
That's why we're here.
Okay. Well, so follow up. What do anthroposophical teachings of Austrian mystic Rudolf Steiner, who you mentioned, and Helena Blavatsky's Theosophy tell us about Atlantis?
This is it, because they were laying it out and they were putting it together. So 1909, Rudolf Steiner writes a book and it's called Cosmic Memory. And the book is all about the fundamental history of Atlantis, how it started, how it ended, and how Egypt and the Mayas and the Incas became the legacy cultures. The follow-up on that is the Casey work. And previous to that is Blavatsky's work. But they're all saying the same thing. Casey's the most expansive, I would say, on it. But here is Steiner saying, you know, at a certain point, this culture became very advanced, but they saw what was happening with the degeneration, the overexposure, and the temptation of the technology. So they took 1,000 of their best people, and who they went to Ireland originally to start another civilization. But eventually that group were the group that went into Egypt. And they became the legacy culture, Egypt with the pyramids and everything else. So Steiner's giving us that hint. But when you get to Casey, he starts talking about there's a hall of records that's been buried in Egypt under the Giza Plateau that's over 10,000 years old. Then Casey goes further and says, well, you know, the reason they placed it there was because they were doing archaeology in 10,500 BC. It was already an ancient sacred spot. So there's something about the plateau itself that made it ideal for what they wanted to do. And Casey is saying humanity, by reacquiring information about Atlantis and the Two-Eye Stone, is going to come back into a knowledge, a memory of this whole thing. And Steiner is basically telling us, well, you're looking at a culture where if you go into Atlantis, they were so spiritually evolved. But because the spiritual evolution that they had took place under the Amelius group, the other group that was the Belial group that imitated them, imitated their achievements and things, but used the technology that they were using to contact the outer spheres, the saintly realm, and that they had developed this for, they were using the technology for a totally different purpose. And that's where they actually originally split the islands into three islands and then caused volcanic eruptions. You know, this is where the whole Apotheum thing comes from. Because whatever took place in Atlantis, and I can tell you, I've talked to the best researchers, the best scientists, Graham Hancock, you know, Robert Schock and others. They say what had to have been a comet, it had to have been a pole shift, something devastating on that line. Mm. But Steiner says, no, it's not. It's not any of those. It is using the Atlantean technology and setting off a destruction. So the equivalent of us setting off our own nuclear disaster. And the remnants after the fact, what would happen to this culture? Well, I mean, people do a great job with the thing that they do, but they don't know, you know, most of us don't know how the technology works. Most of us don't know how the cars work or the planes work or anything. So if the society gets wiped out on that level, what will happen? It'll go back into a kind of a primitive state again, and there'll be a memory of when these things could have been done. Now, it's been popularized here and there, science fiction, Planet of the Apes or whatever, But I think there's a root idea there in the subconscious of humanity that something went terribly wrong. That's where the echoes, because remember, the whole Atlantis story is based on Plato's account. Mm-hmm. Plato's saying, he's not saying, oh, I wrote this. He's saying, I got this through a relative who had been to Egypt and talked to the Egyptian priests. And it's a true account that 9,000 years before I'm writing, all these Atlantean things took place. And then the Atlanteans were taken out by the gods, basically. They disappeared in one day and one night, but they were the height of culture. Well, 9,000 years before Plato, it's basically 9,500 BC, Casey says 10,000 BC, these things link up, they add up. When you are looking at a kind of a clairvoyant version of this, and then Plato is basically a teacher. So he's giving you a historical account based on someone he knew who went and talked to the priests in Egypt. So it's not that it's some story that somebody made up. He's, you know, he's not giving us a story. He's giving us a history.
Yeah.
So we have that. And in all of the accounts, when you get into the Mayan story or our story of the flood or any of these things, there's an account of a great destruction back there and a small group that survived. So it looks like, you know, we're kind of heading into the possibility of that happening again. And I think that's where all the mystery school information has come out, let's say over the past 150 years or so. Because before that, if you talked about those things, you'd pretty much be burned at the stake.
You keep that reincarnation. Under wraps.
So, you know, for me, I guess the best answer to that is Steiner and Blavatsky are adding another layer. And it's all about humanity awakening in this period to that sort of spiritual side mixed. It's like a spiritual science. So you're scientifically advancing, but you're taking your spiritual side with you. And Steiner's version of the harmonic force is that it splits. It's all technology. And it's interesting because Steiner, at one point, tried to do a sculpture of this Ahriman figure. And as he was doing it, this is a very logical guy. I mean, you know, Steiner created anthroposophy. He created biodynamic farming. He was a genius. But he said while he was working on it, he felt like he was embedded in concrete. So that he got heavier and heavier and realized he had to, like, finish it quickly. And the image that he captures is pretty ghastly. But as he tuned into this thing, he was like, he got more and more information about it. And he saw that it was a purely scientific, technological force that was happy to control humanity. And that humanity ran the risk of losing their own spiritual evolution by engaging with this. And so his warning, it's very interesting. What I've said about Steiner is kind of fascinating because I think Steiner spent 4 decades trying to warn humanity. And, you know, when you read his stuff, it's chilling because he's got the internet in there. He's got the technological surrender in there. He's writing the headlines 100 years ago. How does that work?
He was waiting for you to find
them. Exactly.
So what is it that you refer to the Giza Gate and who is suppressing important discoveries in Egypt right now? Like right now.
Right now. It's happening now. Actually, there's a news story from today suppressing the story. So you're exactly right. Here's the thing. Here's why I call it Gizagate. And it's a very interesting, winding labyrinth of a story, but I'll try to sum it up this way.
You can do it.
There's a group in America who supports the Casey research work, and they support and spend lots of money on archaeological digs in places like Egypt to prove Casey's theories. So one of the things that they did is they put 2 very interesting people through college and placed them in Cairo to be their men in Cairo who would get the real story for them so it would support Casey's work and his predictions and all the rest of it. One of those characters was Zahi Hawass. The other one was Mark Lehner. Lehner, by the way, is retired now. He's over at he's over by BU. He has an office over there. So, but Lehner was a high school dropout. And the Casey Foundation was like, you know, you're very interested in this stuff. We think you'd be good. They put him through college. They did the whole thing. Hawass also had kind of an unsteady educational background. And the Casey Foundation said, we'll put you through Cairo University, University of Pennsylvania, all these other places. So they did. They paid for it. So these guys go over there. They know all about the Casey readings. They've spent time. They're close to the Casey family. They go over there in the 1990s, and they become kind of the big shots. They control the Giza Plateau. They rise in the ranks. Little by little, they start making it very difficult to do digs anywhere around the Sphinx or the pyramid, and they publicly trash the theories that Casey has put out about Atlantis and all the rest. They're like, there's no evidence of an ancient culture. Forget about it. So what happens is Hawass joins the Mubarak government, and they make him the Minister of Antiquities. And he throws all of these archaeologists out, and he starts doing these deals where they're million-dollar deals with National Geographic and all the rest, where he invites them in to look at this, and like he's the curator. And they do all these stories about him as Indiana Jones and all this stuff. In the meantime, Lehner is saying, oh, yeah, all the Casey stuff was wrong. And, you know, it's traditional dating. It just, you know, the pyramid's 2500 BC, and there's nothing here, nothing to look at. Now, there's a geologist who's also from BU, Robert Schock, is a great researcher. And he realized that there was a weathering pattern on the Sphinx that was rain-based. It was a water weathering pattern. The problem is there hasn't been rain in Egypt since 10,500 BC. You have to go all the way back there to get it. So he's like, the weathering pattern shows the Sphinx, the age of the Sphinx is 10,500 BC. And then he said, I don't know anything about Edgar Casey or whatever, but I can tell you for sure that this is it. So this is the battle that's gone on for 20 years. And a number of people have been involved, Robert Bavall, Graham Hancock, and others. And they always had this iron gate to go up against trying to get more information about Casey's Hall of Records. Now, that group, Lehner and Hawass, know all about the Hall of Records. They know all about the Casey readings. And they even get the Casey Foundation, even though they publicly trash Casey, they get the Casey Foundation to continue to fund digs around the Sphinx and all the rest. The thing that they've done with the information is they've searched for the artifacts. This is part of the archaeology wars. They've looked for the Hall of Records. They've looked for the Atlantean stuff. They have not shared it with the ARE, with the public, or anything. These are the Casey Foundation people. They put them there. And what I think is fascinating about these guys is they're still, not Lehner anymore. He's not around active. But Hawass, he's the first guy who came out and said, the space radar story can't be true. Egyptians built this pyramid. It's not based on an ancient culture before the Egyptians. And he's the one who's coming out and saying, I'm going to push back against these other scientists that are coming out against this. So there's an incredible block there. But if you look at the Mubarak government, you know, Mubarak, he was in prison for many years for all the corruption. And he took Hawass into his cabinet. And Hawass, they had a number of cases against Hawass, bribery and all these other things. So you have a very corrupt situation there managing this ancient artifacts and the ancient civilization and the human origin story. So that's a big problem. And I think it goes deep. And I think that they need characters like that to deflect the public around what the actual age of the Sphinx and the pyramids are. With the space radar story, which remember, that story only came out about 10 days ago.
Yeah.
That story is going to be undeniable scientific fact for this. So then these people over here who are controlling access and maybe have been digging for that Casey information and digging for this stuff for their own governments, for their own corruption, I can't tell you how much money is in archaeology. You know, if you could, you know, go back and find King Tut's tomb back in the day, that became this incredible thing. But every discovery of a temple or whatever it happens to be. It's television specials, books, and everything else. So there's a whole system that feeds itself on keeping that story going. And if you can't, if the kind of third rail is talking about Atlantis or Casey or any of that stuff, you can't go near it because you've built up this whole scientific thing. If you start talking about there's a civilization back there and it was more advanced than we are, that's a real big problem.
And so, we all know egos, yes, you know.
Exactly. That's Gizagate, because they're Casey people. And it's funny, because tonight I brought the book that Lena wrote about Casey and Hall of Records, and I'll show that to you when we're done. But, you know, just to show that these people know all about, you know, oh, Casey's supposed to be some far-out guy who's like, you know, some crazy psychic predictions, forget about it. And yet, there they are, being funded through universities, going there on Casey scholarships, and trashing his work in the meantime. So that, for me, is Gizagate. There's a lot of corruption levels going on there. And those two people should be called out professionally for taking the money on one side and biting it on the other. You know, and they're very happy to trash his work.
That's amazing. Take money, but
exactly.
Your work is wrong.
Well, what's interesting to me in particular with Lehner is that Schock, who's in a different profession, he's a geologist. So you can't, with your Egyptian history, deny his scientific dating of something, because he's the geologist.
Yeah.
He knows what the date would be. He knows what the rain pattern, the weathering on the Sphinx is. So, you know, for me, that's a dramatic thing that they were just blocking them and using their position to keep that story out because it supported Casey's version of the story, and you can't talk about Casey's version of the story.
Or else. Okay, so you said that many prominent political, historical figures and celebrities have been deeply involved in the search for Atlantis. Who are some of the main people involved?
This is fascinating because it seems to be something transferred over time among groups. Literary groups, sometimes. Political groups.
Celebrities.
John Lennon bought lots in the Atlantic Ocean because he believed, based on the mystery school work, that land was rising. And if that land rises, then it's in international waters. It's anyone's nation. Ernest Hemingway, we did such a thorough episode on the hot zone and Ernest Hemingway. And Hemingway's job for a while there was scouting all that between Bimini and Cuba. And Ernest Hemingway's brother, he buys a lot near Jamaica in the ocean, and he creates the New Atlantis with a flag and with a constitution and the whole bit. So there's an awareness, there are breadcrumbs, there's like footprints of this group over time. One of the people who you might be surprised, you've never heard of probably, who was vice president of the United States under Calvin Coolidge in the 1920s. His name was Vice President Dawes. That's him there in Panama. And what do you think he's doing in Panama?
He's on a mission. He is searching.
He's searching for Atlantis, which he did for a decade. And this is one of the guys who set up the Federal Reserve. He's a very deep player. And there are articles in the New York Times, Washington Post, and all the rest, all about his travels and his obsession with Atlantis. And he was going to be the president, in fact, in 1928, but there was the whole thing about the Depression and everything else, so he never got to run. But there you have the presidential level. If you look at Henry Wallace, who's the vice president under FDR, he's a theosophist, one. Two, he's on a search for Atlantis because he's realized that the Mayan language is so similar to the Egyptian language. And so there's this thread in politics through the secret societies and through these other groups, like we were talking about. I think Dawes is particularly interesting because one of the things that he did when he wasn't satisfied after a 10-year search was he petitioned the Vatican Library for all their information around Atlantis. And he sent a Yale researcher in there to get that information. and we never got anything from his report of what happened. But obviously there's some understanding that the Vatican archives hold the key to Atlantis. And it's funny, this is how I'll back that up. We did a whole section in our last Hacking Atlantis episode, you and I, on Paulina Zelitsky, who was this very fascinating Russian oceanographer who went to Cuba and then defected to Canada. And she found a whole underground, underwater city off Cuba. Well, it's very interesting because she wrote a book as a follow-up just recently called Dog Days in Cuba. And she had to put it all in mythical terms about this dog who wanders around Cuba. But one of the things the dog observes is that in 1998, the Pope comes to Cuba, which is true. Of course, it happened in real life. But he comes, apparently, because Castro tells him, I've found Atlantis off the coast, and I want you, with your Vatican library information, to cross-reference what I've found with what you have in the Vatican. And she wrote the book as this kind of pseudo-fairy tale. And yet, she was there. She was in Cuba. She's the one who found the city. And she probably is still under a gag order, not being able to say anything about it. After all, she spent time in a Mexican prison for 30 days when they were trying to intimidate her to get her away from her studies there, when they had originally called her in and Castro had hired her to find Spanish galleons. And Spanish galleons is basically a keyword for, hey, we're looking for ancient ruins off there in the Bahamas. And, you know, Spanish galleons is the kind of catch-all term because then nobody knows what you're looking for. Therefore, they're not on your tail.
Oh. 30 days in prison.
Oh, yeah, they intimidated her pretty well, so much so that when I offered her the chance to be interviewed and talk about all this, she said, I'm not sure that you can change what's going on there with the cover. And I said, well, you're an important voice. And archaeology dropped the ball because when you discovered this city off the coast of Cuba, because it was a Cuban story, it hit everywhere. And so nobody could deny the story. The only thing they could do is get you out of the picture to get rid of the story. And then archaeology, they didn't, you know, they were instructed, don't go into this. But it's very clear of what she found. So these are the ruins now, taking a look at here, of what she found off the coast of Cuba. Now, I don't think there's anything that you can say in terms of history that would allow for those types of ruins being off the coast of Cuba. And she said when she sent the submersibles down, what they found were hieroglyphs. And the reporter asked her what kind of hieroglyphs. And she said, Mayan hieroglyphs. So there's an older Mayan culture off the coast of Cuba, which is right there in that hot zone area. Well, what else is in the hot zone area? How far is Bimini from Cuba? They're very close. They're less than an hour away from each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, by boat. So, you know, when you're talking less than 90 miles. Therefore, that Cuban find, the Pope coming in, all these things about Zelitsky is a gigantic story and supports the other half of what Casey was saying, which is there's a Hall of Records, there's a Poseidon Hall of Records off the coast of Bimini, and that all extended out off to Cuba. That's the hot zone area. So the ruins, therefore, are rising. Our technology is rising with the space radar, which is how we got the Giza find. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, it's going to be indisputable. And then what? You're going to need a different human origin story. So the question is, whose human origin story are you going to get? Are you going to get one based on the evidence? Or are you going to get something else? So this stuff is still suppressed.
The cover-up.
Yes. So National Geographic don't want anything to do with it.
Huh.
But there it is. And, you know, the whole thing about her company being hired by Castro, the background of it, it's indisputable. So therefore, they just are avoiding it to avoid it. Because whoever is actually doing the research, that's a different story. Because obviously somebody is researching.
Yes. Who are these figures in the Casey and Steiner Mystery School cosmology that we've been talking about, like Rata for the first one?
Okay. So Rata's a high priest who comes into Egypt and is the intermediary with the Atlanteans and sets up the Giza Plateau. And what he does is they design the Great Pyramid. And designing the Great Pyramid, they use archaeoastronomy. They use mathematics. They use geometry in order to make it a tremendous time capsule. And, you know, it was asked of Casey once, there's this whole thing about pyramid predictions. Are there predictions in the pyramid? And he said, yeah, if you know how to read it in the language of mathematics and geometry, you can read it down to the detail of people who will show up in history, down to the family last name and the address of the street that they grew up on. Hmm. Obviously, the pyramid is not a tomb for some pharaoh somewhere. It does something totally different, which is not very clear exactly what that is, but it's something else. Now, Rata is part of the saving the records that are coming from Atlantis, and they set up the Sphinx to put the Hall of Records beneath in a pyramid. Now, the pyramid, I'm calling the pyramid Pyramid X, just because we do X steganography. Steiner and Casey refer to this pyramid, but Casey goes even further. He says, the Hall of Records is in a pyramid, and it is between then the Sphinx and the river, and the paw is the entryway for it. So what they've done is they've focused so much on the paw and, you know, in the Egyptian antiquities, they've done a lot of things around there. But of course, if you remove certain things, that whole thing could collapse. That's their excuse. Mm. So my guess is they're doing tons of research in relation to that. But here's Casey saying, what it is, the Hall of Records is in a pyramid. That's what it is. It's a buried pyramid. Now, Casey got a lot of support, interestingly enough, because when they discovered Göbekli Tepe, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is dated by traditional archaeology. It's 12,000 years ago. It's a full megalithic setup. And now it's on the record. So Casey, back in the day, saying the pyramids are 12,000 years old, had no support because everyone would look around and say, well, there's nothing advanced in that period. Now there's Göbekli Tepe, which is pretty damn close to Egypt in Turkey. So therefore, you have things happening there in history that are showing that Casey's recollections, reflections on this are correct. So Rata is that high priest, and it's very strange because as Casey describes him, and this is part of the cosmology, I suppose, he says, well, he was without human father. So he's something else. We don't know what he was referring to. And people speculate, is he Nephilim? Is he an alien? What is he? Well, whoever Rata was in the readings, he doesn't have a human father. So is he a product of controlled genetics? I don't know. But he's a key figure in all of this.
That's so interesting. Okay, well, so what about Amelius?
Amelius is very interesting. He is the character in Atlantis. He's kind of like the Christ figure in Atlantis. And there's a lot of correlation that Casey makes about Christ and Amelius. But what I can say about Amelius is that he's the one who sets the tone for Atlantis becoming an advanced technological civilization with a high ideal. And it is the Belial group that imitates what Amelius can do, but they take the same technology that Amelius uses they train priestesses, they communicate with the saintly realm and what Casey calls the outer spheres. Well, the Belial group basically studies Amelius, imitates him, and takes the same information and uses it for a domineering technology. And so you get these two applications of technology in the Casey story. So Amelius, I guess, would be the Christ figure, and Belial is kind of like Satan, basically. And they are archetypal, for sure.
Next question. What is the Poseidon Temple, and is the Bimini Wall evidence of the Bahamas Hall of Records?
Yeah, this is fascinating. Poseidia is what Casey referred to. It's kind of like the New York or the Paris of Atlantis. It's the center core, but it's the stronghold of the Amelius group. That is the area there in the Caribbean. So you've got the whole hot zone area. You've got Cuba, yep. You have Bimini and the Bahamas. And so many strange things happen there. Not only is it a major UFO sighting hotspot, so common that they call them fireflies down there. But you have the thing with the spinning compasses, of course, Bermuda Triangle is close by. All of that stuff, the magnetic anomalies, apparently relate to the fact that this two-eye stone was there on Poseidia. And Poseidia, at a certain point, turned the crystal, two-eye stone, too high, and it took the island down. That's the story in the Casey Reading. So it's very strange that we get all these magnetic anomalies there now, because, again, you get this impression of, you know, there's something still happening there that is creating this kind of apotheum magnetic effect, so that still, even all these years later, you know, you get missing planes, missing boats, you know, all these things that have happened there in that period, and it's all due to this kind of anomaly. I remember talking to a guy who was the captain of a ship in that area. And I talked to a lot of people off the record because if they talked about the hot zone, according to the military, they can be court-martialed. So what he said was that they were doing a routine, like a drug patrol there in that area, and that at a certain point, a huge thing showed up in front of him that was like a gigantic obelisk, basically. And this is very interesting because there's something down there called AUTEC, which is basically like the underwater Area 51. And they are on an island called Andros, which is right off Bimini. So it's all taking place right there. So there's a gigantic military presence down there, and they are practicing very different experimental underwater things. So I found that interesting. One of those guys who left AUTEC, he came out and said, I was there at AUTEC at a certain point. I was on, you know, doing kind of a patrol around that area. And then suddenly a landmass showed up on our radar, an entire landmass. And he said, well, you know, I'm a radar expert. I know what a landmass looks like. And he said, you know, and when they asked him, was it a ship? Was it something else? He said, no, it's a landmass. So there was a landmass that appeared for him. And he's come out now and talked about this publicly. So how does that add up in any of the things that we're talking about? Well, there's something strange about the area generally. But the idea that a landmass could appear and then disappear on radar shows you that there's either some kind of electronic technology, a portal, whatever it happens to be. And you've got the American government running the most secret underwater program, AUTEC, AUTEC, right there, a stone's throw from Bimini. So they're working with it, whatever it happens to be. And that guy from AUTEC doesn't know what it was. I can't tell you what it was. Yet, here we go again. You're right around where Casey said, well, there's a Poseidian temple down there. So there's an intrigue with it. There's not a lot of explanations.
TBD. Hopefully. How does the Casey and Steiner belief in reincarnation relate to the retrocognition and rediscovery of our ancient past in Atlantis?
Well, this is really an interesting thing when we think about it on the reincarnation side, because some people believe in it, some people don't. But it has crept into culture over, say, the past, you know, 100 years or so. And there was no, you know, unless you were in India or somewhere on that side of the world, over here in America in the 1800s, it didn't come up. So the Theosophical Society and H.P. Blavatsky came over from Russia. She had studied in Tibet at these mystery schools and went to Egypt and then came over here working with a mystery school to do this Theosophical teaching in America. And reincarnation was at the heart of what she was saying. And the idea is, you know, you come back in a different lifetime, you do different things. And when you come in with a particular talent, like somebody like Mozart, the reason he's so great at 4 years old is probably because he did this before. And there are reincarnation patterns. So then you get to Steiner's work, and he talks about reincarnation. And he says, Alexander the Great was Thomas Jefferson. And he says John the Baptist was Raphael. And he shows the archetypes of these individuals coming back and embodying in these different lives different things, different qualities, but they are kind of, you know, these legendary figures. But everyone reincarnates, because the idea is in the mystery school literature of Casey, Steiner, and the like, when you leave this life, you go through different planetary sojourns around this system, and you don't have a physical body. You take on the elements that are in that system, and you know, you go through Venus, Mercury, and all the rest. Then you bring all that back to your life here. So that's reincarnation. Now, one of the things I found interesting in the heart of that is Casey saying, well, in the memory of these people that are coming in now from Atlantis, they remember the technology. Mm. So the things that we're going to be discovering are actually rediscoveries. And when we get into rediscovering, we're rediscovering the scientific aspect, the psychic aspect, all these other pieces. So you're getting the good part and you're getting the bad part, the same temptation. But what happened the last time was the Belial group and the Emilius group fought. And the Belial group won, but they destroyed Atlantis and almost the whole planet. So as these people come back in, it's very interesting, because I read an intelligence study where they go back and regress individuals, and they started to do reincarnation regression on people to say, can I do this past life regression and get this certain amount of details out of them? And nobody thought anything of it with the Central Intelligence Agency, because they were like, well, it's another one of these weird things that they're doing. Well, if you take the Casey information and you really spread it out, what you're looking at is they're probing the unconscious minds of these people to say, what is it that you could do in that lifetime? So the reincarnation thing is a big jump for, you know, you don't have to believe in reincarnation to understand these things at all. And yet it's a tool employed heavily by Casey and others to go back through these lives. So when Casey gives 900 readings on Atlantis over a 40-year period, and the story is very consistent, it's very strange. And they asked him once, where are you getting the information for this? And he said, from the subconscious mind of the person who's asking for it. So in your subconscious, you already know the information about this lifetime and the things that took place there are already in there. So, you know, if you were there during the Atlantean destruction, it's there as an unconscious, a cultural memory. And so you have the good side studying that, let's say, on the mystery school side, they're trying to move the culture forward with it. But you have things like intelligence agencies and secret societies studying it to get that information. So I guess you could say things like what we were talking about with Neuralink and other things become dangerous in that context, because they're kind of sucking up these unconscious memories. And I think that there's a level there to penetrate about how do these groups get this information?
Yeah.
If it's true, like, and like I said, you don't have to accept reincarnation, but if it's true and you have lived through it and it was advanced, then somebody has the ability to take that from your unconscious. So I think it represents a kind of a danger in that sense. There's a rediscovery on one hand. So it's very important for us to say, well, we've been through this before. But on the other hand, someone else can also glean information from that. So the reincarnation thing, I think, is quite fascinating. And what's interesting to me is the consistency in mystery school teachings about who was reincarnated as. For example, both Casey and Steiner say that Alexander the Great was Thomas Jefferson, or they say that John the Baptist was Raphael. Well, think about John the Baptist and then his life as John the Baptist, and then Raphael comes in and creates this whole Renaissance in art. It's very interesting to me how that could play a major role if people understood it. But we have it kind of like reincarnation is sort of commercialized right now. And so people, I think, largely dismiss it. And yet I think it's a crucial core element in the mystery school work. So I would call it very important to get to the root of that. And certainly it's very important in both of their teachings.
Absolutely. What are the Akashic Records and esoteric teachings, and what is the cycle of destruction?
This is interesting because, again, we're finding some kind of Eastern concepts in the mystery schools, but these are Western mystery schools. So apparently in the tradition on the Western side, they had things like reincarnation. They had things like the Akashic Record. And the Akashic Record is interesting because the idea is that it's a chronicle of everything that's ever happened to human life. And that basically it's written on, you know, the skein of time and space, and that it can be tapped into. It's very interesting. There's an inventor, and many important inventors came to Casey during his lifetime, including Edison, Tesla, and others. The Tesla reading disappeared, by the way. But the scientist came in and said, you know, you've talked about these Akashic Records, and if you read the Akashic Records, you can go back in time, and you can, you know, if you're clairvoyant, you can see things that happened in ancient Persia or the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, whatever it happens to be. And here's Casey going through that and looking at Atlantis, going that far back. So this retrocognition that he has as a psychic, he's looking back over that past. But Akashic comes, again, out of the Eastern tradition. They understood that it's played out there. And so the guy is asking Casey this question. He says, can you create a machine that can read these things? And Casey said, oh, easily. You could do it. And he lays out in a reading how to formulate reading the Akashic Record with a technological machine. So you can see that there's something about this idea. Now, whenever you get into levels of the mystery schools and the figures like Gurdjieff, Steiner, Blavatsky, and others, they all talk about the Akashic Records. So obviously, it's something that they're aware of, that throughout history, there's a way to tune in to those things and actually read them. And what's funny is Casey mentions, well, there's a number of people in our ancient past who could read the records. Plato was one of them. And part of his knowing the Atlantis story is him tapping into this. So that is a leap into kind of a clairvoyant vision. But again, the mystery schools, they brought over meditation. They brought over concepts, life after death, and things of this nature, because the Western tradition, it was absent. In the Christian tradition, you didn't have reincarnation. Life after death was resurrection, or purgatory, or heaven, whatever it happened to be. So this is a little different, and it's saying, no, in the original Christian mysticism, you had all these things. They were taken out at a certain point, but this is where the mystical aspect shares something in common with the Eastern schools, where it wasn't taken out. Of course, in the Eastern schools, reincarnation went all over the top when it was like, oh no, this person did something bad. They reincarnated as, you know, a bulldog.
A fly.
Yeah. But the true term around reincarnation, there's no transmigration. You're a human and you go through different stages. That's what it's about. So I think looking where the Western mystery tradition takes us is important, because apparently that's how we can reincorporate the mystical side of this into this culture. Because otherwise, you've got a Christianity that's cut off from things of this nature. You know, I know that there's a lot of Christian teachings that would think something like, you know, reincarnation is a kind of blasphemy. And yet, it comes out in all kinds of different early Christian work, that there's reincarnation there. It has to be removed at a certain point. And so the mystery schools maintain the tradition. So in fact, the mystery schools have mystic Christianity and they have mystic Buddhism. They're two different levels.
What is the Piri Reis map, and how did an ancient culture map out of the globe without space satellites?
This is going to get us really to kind of the climax of this. So the Piri Reis map is from 1502. It's from Admiral Piri Reis. Mm-hmm. It's a Turkish admiral. And it was involved, by the way, in a major American power struggle President Eisenhower try to get the map from Spain. And he spent 6 years to get it, and he got it. But Spain wanted to keep it. So Admiral Curie said, "This is my map. By the way, I didn't make this map. This map comes from an ancient monastery." The problem for historians with the Curie's map is that it shows Antarctica with no ice on it, one. So it shows the whole landmass underneath Antarctica without the ice. And then it shows the entire world like you snapshot it from a satellite. So how does Admiral Curie in 1502 get a space satellite shot? You know, the map is authenticated. Everyone knows what it is. And he says, well, the monastery that I got it from, they go all the way back to 3000 BC. So he got it from an ancient monastery. Somebody was keeping that. This is, again, the mystery school tradition of holding the technology and passing it down. But somebody was in possession of that. Now, when you get into things like the Nazca Lines in Peru, we only discovered the Nazca Lines in Peru because we got flight after the Wright brothers. And then we were flying over these planes, and then we're seeing all these images waving back at us. So if we hadn't done it, we never would have seen them. Nobody can see them from the ground level because of the way they're done. So it's basically like a South American airport, but it's ancient. And that's not ancient aliens. That's an advanced technology that we were in possession of at a certain point. That's why, in my opinion, when you put those things together about ancient flight, you go directly back into the Casey readings, and he says the Atlanteans cracked anti-gravity. Well, anti-gravity is the heart of the problem that we get around the UFO thing, because they're anti-gravity.
Yeah.
And all the studies in the 50s and 60s that were, you know, had to go underground and all the rest, and that we never hear anything about, T.T. Brown and all the rest of it, those people are like, we don't know how they're working, but they have anti-gravity. Well, this is an old, rediscovered technology, and we definitely have anti-gravity now. And the question is, whenever we see these things, who's operating? Well, it's not always somebody else, right? We've cracked it to a point where we're looking at something that we can operate. So there's a tremendous crisscross at this point in history between the ancient advancements in the past, which can be proven through things like the Curie's map or the Nazca Lines, and the technology that went black under the U.S. government starting in the 1950s. So basically the key to the whole thing is the technological advancement. And this is the nature of the problem.
When did it start?
It's a lot older.
It's not new. Okay, so how does CERN play a role in all of this then?
Well, this is fascinating because CERN, now, they did the Hadron Collider, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. And CERN is quite interesting because it's sort of a breakthrough between modern technology and ancient technology. But what it was set up for was set up by these scientists to find the God particle. But it had a $21 billion budget, which is very strange in any scientific circle. So people started to wonder immediately, is there some military purpose behind it? And I dug into CERN and the collider and found very odd things, including the fact that they had a huge scandal there for doing an occult ritual that got caught on camera in front of CERN. And the Hadron Collider becomes this thing that's sort of worshipped in these scientific circles because they're worshipping this incoming of a communication from another dimension. Technically, CERN is set up to find the God particle. Higgs boson is what they call it. But with that big budget, everyone assumed something else was going on. And so then they started to create papers about it and saying, no, you know, all those rumors are false. There's nothing strange going on. We're just looking for the Higgs boson. But then they found it. So technically you'd think, okay, their work is moving on to something else. This thing about particle colliding is quite fascinating. Deep in the literature, if you look into it, these scientists say we're trying to contact another dimension through CERN, through the Hadron Collider, in fact. So they've mapped out gigantic tunnels there in France, Switzerland, and other places. And they are using this as a gigantic particle smasher. Somehow in the middle of all that, they recreate the conditions, they say, of the Big Bang. And so then the whole concept of strangelets came up. And this is interesting. A group of scientists sued CERN because they said, your Higgs boson particle smashing experiments can release strangelets. And guess what? Strangelets can form black holes. And if you form a black hole, you can suck up a country, or, you know, it's a big problem, basically, to create a black hole. So they sued them, and then they tried to find out who owned CERN and who was actually doing this. And they found out that CERN was a sovereign country, and that the way it was set up was very much like Vatican City or something like this. There was no way to sue them. They are their own independent thing. So digging in a little deeper on CERN gets us into occult territory, because there's a whole occult wing inside of CERN which thinks that they can use the technology to interact with beings, intelligences that are on a different dimension, literally. So that's very much like the Two-Eye Stone in that sense. And you can see that the CERN Hadron Collider is sort of Atlantean-style technology. It's also very innovative, kept very tight and underground, and has a funny, you know, sort of, you know, they had Tom Hanks start it up. He was like, hey, I'm going to start it up. It's CERN, Large Hadron Collider. I'm going to flip the switch. You know, they have their PR thing, but it's a very strange project, highly funded. And now other countries are looking at CERN and trying to develop their own, saying, we think it's a weapon. It actually has a weapons use. So I think when we're talking about technology that is kind of a spiritual technology that could be misused, CERN is a good modern example.
That's so interesting. And the PR, I'm sure they brought in.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Tom Hanks likes it.
Well, so why do you think ancient Egypt was chosen as the main place to hold humanity's sacred secrets? And why did the Atlantean initiates place the records there in the first place?
This is really the heart of the problem when it comes to Egypt, because it holds so much of the focus of the ancient past. And in the mystery schools, it's a major center. What's interesting that I find when talking about Egypt is that Casey said when this group in 10,500 BC was looking for a place as a repository for these records for humanity's future, that they were doing archaeology to do that. So the plateau in Egypt is so old. Then there's a whole history in theosophy that says in 50,000 BC, there was a temple of Isis on the plateau. It was inundated, and then the culture came back. So there's something very old and strange about this, but it obviously is a major center. You know, you have all these power spots around the world, like so many people talk about Sedona, Arizona, for example. And they are places that are identified as power spots by these mystery schools, probably based on a kind of magnetic profile as a center for universal activity. But Egypt, really, if you think about it, is the instigator of our own culture, because they're the first civilization. Sumeria is an earlier civilization, technically, but in Casey's work, it's Atlantis with Egypt that is the first major culture, the first major legacy culture. So Egypt has a lot, you know, we're learning a lot from that lesson. It was the center, the focal point. And I believe that on the mystical side, obviously, the great achievements there, that the pyramid became a center for the initiates to do the mystery school initiations. And so supposedly in the pyramid are all those symbols. One of the symbols, if you go into the pyramid, into the king's chamber, is an empty sarcophagus. So the idea is the realization when you get to that level is no more death.
Mm.
Death is understood. There's no fear. There's no, you know, you understand it from a spiritual interface level. So when we go into the pyramid, just to say briefly, most advanced mathematics anywhere, the base of the pyramid is 365.24, which is exactly our calendar year run. So it's based on such a deep wisdom and a knowledge of numerology, you know, geology, that I think it's still, it's the repository, the reflection of a very advanced culture telling us in the future as an archetype, you know, here's, this is the message.
Yeah.
And you, yeah, and it's wide open for you to explore, you know. But I think it's interesting that people were drawn to it, and that people like Napoleon, for example, who advanced Egyptology a lot, but, you know, he wanted to have dynamite blow up the side of the pyramid so you get in there. I mean, you know, these are the types of things that we have, that the culture around it hasn't lived up to what's been left there for humanity, but there it still sits.
Waiting for that dynamite.
I could tell you other things about Napoleon there.
Well, okay. My last question for you. What can we expect to be revealed in your Atlantis Hall of Records research based on the new Giza Plateau discovery, and will it lead to the Pyramid X discovery? And wait, lastly, how will this change our understanding of our ancient past and actually rewrite history, like now?
The Giza Plateau discovery by space radar blows all of the denial away. So there's been a pressure there that's built up, and Casey and the mystery schools have been responsible for some of it, for sure, because he predicted what it was. So the problem is, archaeology is sitting there as an establishment saying, no, the pyramids are 2500 BC, the Sphinx is 2500 BC, it was built by Egyptians, and all the rest of it. The record shows, one, the Sphinx comes from a rain-weathered period, it's over 10,500 BC, and that the pyramids, basically, there's nothing contemporary in the pyramid. Khufu is credited with the pyramid. There's no markings. There's nothing that says in there, I'm Khufu, this is my pyramid. There's no statue of Khufu in the pyramid. So they just credited Khufu this. Now, what's interesting about the space radar findings is they're found under the second pyramid, the Khafre pyramid, which is behind the Sphinx. What's interesting about that is the Khafre pyramid connects underground with all this. What they've found with the space radar breakthrough, which is remarkable, the SAR breakthrough, is that it goes down 700 yards. That's 7 football fields. What kind of a culture could build a support structure like that? Not the one that they credit. They barely give them credit for the wheel.
Yeah.
So that culture couldn't have done it with slaves rolling blocks. Obviously, a different technology was used there. And this is that technology that goes back to the Emilius group and the Casey work. That is the conclusion that makes a lot more sense than the materialist version that we're getting from traditional archaeology. The problem is that the culture itself, the people who are studying it, don't want to share that with the public. And, you know, the Hawass types and the others who built up this kind of power pyramid that they sit on top of, they don't have any real incentive to share that with the public. Problem is, the public has discovered on their own this discovery, and now the clash is what takes place there. And we see so many things falling down now, you know, where the walls of secrecy don't work. So what they need to do is create a secondary narrative. They need to create their own narrative based on these historical incidents. That's what we're looking at here. By crafting the narrative, they get the control of the human origin story. In the meantime, they get the real thing.
Yeah.
So this is the nature of being aware of these things I don't think that any group is going to be able ultimately to stop humanity from finding that, because the evidence is overwhelming. And part of it, besides the deeper groups that are looking into it, is just the skeptical lack of belief that an older culture could have been more advanced than we are. That's a big problem. But I think that this is a huge game changer for history. And I think it's going to change the human origin story and the dating system that we use for that story. So therefore, it's going to bring forward then Casey's work, because what did he say? He said basically, there's a hall of records, a pyramid X underneath that structure. Well, that's what we're seeing so far. We're seeing massive underground structures. They haven't found the pyramid yet, but now Casey is much more validated, and I think it gives us tremendous confidence in what we're going to discover there through his work.
Casey feels vindicated.
It was a long road for Casey.
Long time coming for him.
Yeah, but isn't it fascinating that here we are sitting 100 years after he talked about these things and seeing them come to pass with real-time space technology? It's quite remarkable.
It is. You're about to break the internet.
Exactly. Well, we'll both be doing it, that's for sure.
That's true.